Welcome to The Edge. I'm your host, Tom Smith. Have you ever wondered why elections often produce results that seem to be displeasing to many of the voters involved? Would you be surprised to learn that a perfectly fair election can produce an outcome that literally nobody likes? When voting, we often think about the candidates or proposals in the election, but we rarely consider the procedures that we use to express our preferences and arrive at a collective decision. Our guest today wrote the book, The Mathematics of Voting in Elections, A Hands-On Approach. The authors were Jonathan Hodge and Richard Klima. Jonathan Hodge got his Bachelor of Science in Mathematics from Calvin College in Michigan, his Master of Arts degree in Mathematics from Western Michigan University, and his PhD from Western Michigan University as well. He is currently Assistant Professor at Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. Welcome to The Edge, John.
Good morning, Tom.
And Richard Klima received his bachelor's degree in mathematics from Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. He did his graduate studies at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. He completed his Master of Science in Applied Mathematics there and his PhD in the same field, which was completed in 1997. In the spring of 1999, he accepted a position as a cryptologic mathematician with the National Security Agency in Fort George, Meade, Maryland, and he held that position to the summer of 2000, at which time he reentered academia by accepting a position as visiting assistant professor of mathematics at the State University of New York in Oswego. He is currently the assistant professor of mathematics at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing this morning?
Very good. Okay, we're going to look at a number of topics here today. One of them would be the voting that's used in sports for most valuable player. We're going to also look at the history of apportionment and basically the idea behind apportionment of seats to the U.S. House of Representatives. We're going to look at also referendum elections and what can be how they can be very peculiar as far as the results go and what can be done about it. And kind of we're going to look at the mechanics of our political machine. Gentlemen, who wants to start?
Well, I can start by answering the questions that you started us off with today. First, yes, we have wondered why elections often produce results that seem to be displeasing to many of the voters involved. And no, we would not be surprised to learn that a perfectly fair election can produce an outcome that nobody likes because we studied the subject in not too great a detail to come to those conclusions, to that specific conclusion. Right? We were concerned about why elections often produce results that seem to be displeasing to many of the voters. So we looked into the subject and discovered that there's some really strange things that can go on in Democratic-type elections. And it's not something that can happen theoretically. It's something that does happen, and it happens all too often.
Where do we begin with that? With candidates? With referenda?
I guess I would start by this is a great time of year for me, actually, Tom. As college football is starting and baseball is winding up, my two favorite sports get mixed up in the voting world a little bit. So the two things that I like recreationally are sports and election theory. And so college football is a great thing to combine the two because of college rankings, which is one instance where those two things overlap, election theory and sports. And I've actually tried to do some research, some specific research into rankings of college, like college football rankings and also college basketball rankings, but I've been actually rebuffed by the American Football Coaches Association in trying to get a hold of the ballots that they use for their rankings. For college sports rankings, they use a variation of the board account method, mm-hmm. Where every one of the voters submits a ranking, their own personal ranking of the top 25 or so teams, and then those teams on each ballot are assigned points, 25 points for a first place ranking, 24 for a second place ranking, and so forth, down to 1 point for a 25th place ranking. Mm-hmm. And then all of the teams have their points totaled, and it's the total points is how the teams are ranked, and that's how it can periodically happen that teams are ranked, a team can be ranked first, even though somebody else has a larger number of first place votes. But I guess one of the fascinating things about that is a term that actually I heard you, the first time I ever heard this term was when you used it, Tom, the term burying, something that I always in my courses call insincere voting.
Yes.
Burying is when, you know, one voter ranks a legitimate, a candidate that should be legitimately high and ranks them low instead. The board account method that's used for college rankings is highly susceptible to burying.
Yeah.
And insincere voting. And the classic example of that that I like to bring up is from way back in 1991. I like to use this example because it involved Georgia Tech. And this happened just a couple of years after my brother, who played football at Georgia Tech. So a lot of his friends were a part of that team. They ended the season ranked number one according to the UPI poll, which is a coach's poll. It's the predecessor to the current ESPN USA Today poll, that where actually the coaches of the teams are the voters. Georgia Tech finished first that year by a single point over Colorado. So, you know, there was like 800 and something points for Georgia Tech, 800 and something, one less for Colorado. And interestingly enough, the Georgia Tech and Colorado coaches were both voters in that poll. That system obviously is highly susceptible to burying. If the Colorado coach had just ranked Georgia Tech two positions lower, his own team would have benefited by being the national champion that season.
Yeah. So the board account kind of gives you, I guess, what you would call a consensual winner. It's not a majority winner. It's a consensual winner.
And when there are so many teams or candidates ranked, like 25 for college polls, it's even more susceptible to burying.
Yes.
If there were only three candidates ranked, which is how they do Heisman Trophy voting for college football, then, the most you could bury someone is three positions down. Someone who should legitimately be first or second, you could just leave them off your ballot. And it doesn't harm them as much as someone who should be first or second on a 25-candidate ballot. You leave them off your ballot, and you're costing them a lot more. So, yeah, the more candidates, the more susceptible the system is to burying.
Is there a I just wonder, is there a voting method that could be used that doesn't have that susceptibility that would be easy for people to understand, not something really complex?
Well, I mean, I guess you could always just have first place votes be the only thing. The problem with that is, then you wouldn't have a rank. You might not have 25 teams ranked.
Yeah.
There's usually only a handful of teams that get any first place votes at all.
Yeah.
You could certainly reduce the potential for burying by just having fewer teams ranked. And actually, so currently there are 25 teams ranked on each ballot, and they are assigned points 1 through 25 or 25 through 1. But back in 1991, they actually only gave points to the top 15 on each ballot. So it was actually 15 points for first place ranking and 14 for second place and so forth. So that did at least reduce the potential for burying,
so
because you could only, by leaving someone off your ballot, cost them 15 points instead of 25.
So there was like, it was like bottom truncated then. All the rest of them got zero.
Even though back then it was a top 25 poll, it was still a top 25 poll. It was, in effect, you ranked your top 15, and then the next 10 didn't matter. The next 10 were lumped with the other 100 or so teams that were left off the ballot.
Huh.
It's also important to note that, I mean, no matter what voting system we use, we're going to have some sorts of problems. So we might be able to fix the burying problem, but we might introduce other problems. For instance, just going to a plurality system, that system has lots of problems in and of itself. Tom, you mentioned earlier, or perhaps it was Rick, mentioned the issue of manipulability and being able to manipulate systems. And one of the more famous results in voting theory, a more recent result, it deals exactly with that issue. It talks about all voting systems essentially being subject to some sort of manipulability. That's a famous result called the Gibbard-Satterthwaite theorem. And so, again, it's one of these surprising results that we have a real hard time finding systems that do everything we want them to, so we usually have to make some sort of compromise.
Yes. Yes, and you, I guess we would also have to look at the context under which the voting system is being used and actually even try out experimental ballots or just try some mock elections and look at the results and say, does this make sense?
Right. And mock elections would be a good idea, too, as opposed to the BCS system, bowl championship system that is used to select bowl participants in college football. It's they are, in effect, tweaking that system every year because they don't do they don't test it. Every year we run into a new problem, and they tweak the system a little bit. And maybe we would be able to avoid some of those problems if they would have, you know, tried various things on some test data first.
Do you know if they've ever tried range voting, where there's you get to assign any candidate score, let's say between 0 and 9 or 0 and 99, something like that. You know if they've ever tried that
in college rankings?
Yeah.
No, they have always done it the way that it is currently done.
Okay. Interesting.
So, well, and in fairness, the board account is a very well, highly respected system.
Yeah.
One that many professional voting theorists view as the best system available. Like John said, we can fix the burying problem by changing from the board account to something else, but as those of us that have studied voting theory know, if you change the system to avoid one problem, you might and will, you know, introduce some other problem, and that's the problem with the BCS. Every year, they tweak the system a little bit to take care of last year's problem, and a new problem shows up.
Yeah. And as we know, there are always surprises. We might think that, it looks like we run mock elections or whatnot, and we see that a certain behavior is not occurring. The system seems to be working well. We might use it in a real scenario and have something very paradoxical occur. And these things are often hard to predict.
And because you might have people doing tactical voting or certain interests involved in strategic nominations, perhaps.
Sure, and that's another area that's also very hard to predict is, you know, how do we know exactly what sorts of strategies people are going to be employing? There's some research done on, you know, under what circumstances is sincere voting a valid strategy? Under what circumstances does it benefit somebody to vote a choice other than their first choice?
Yeah.
I guess going back to college bowls one more time, we don't know what strategy people use with college rankings because they won't let us see the ballots. All they reveal to us are total points and first place votes. And I and a colleague of mine here at Appalachian who played college football at Wake Forest, so has some experience, you know, in playing the sport, we thought that by the two of us requesting ballots that they might be more inclined to let us see them. But nope, they immediately said no way, the ballots are sealed permanently. So we can't see if there's any kind of strategic voting going on, which is, you know, a dangerous thing because the system is so susceptible to things like burying.
Yeah.
But it's interesting also that we often talk about strategic voting as being something that's bad, but in fact there's some results in the literature that that talk about sophisticated voting, which is essentially strategic voting with where every voter in the system has knowledge of the other voter's preferences. And when you look at voting in that light, actually sophisticated voting has the potential to solve some of the problems that come up with normal, sincere voting. The problem is that we never have complete knowledge of the other voters' preferences, and so it's hard to implement any sort of sophisticated voting on a level that would predictably produce better results.
Hmm. So some information about what other voters, how they're going to vote, is useful.
Sure, it certainly can be, and there's a sense in which we go around in circles when we have this information. I might know somebody else's preferences, so I might vote a certain way in prediction of their preferences, but then they might predict that I'm going to vote that way. And so this gets into a lot of concepts from game theory where we're looking for equilibrium solutions. And given everybody's preferences and given the assumption that everyone has knowledge of everyone else's preferences, would we arrive at some sort of equilibrium outcome that is most satisfactory to the electorate in one way or another?
Yeah, so this sophisticated voting actually could go to an extreme where it becomes more like Byzantine voting.
I suppose so.
Okay, where do we go next?
Well, I guess I could bring up this point about the board account. Another argument against the way the board account is used in college rankings is that it doesn't give enough benefit to first place rankings.
Yep.
First place candidates get 25 points. Second place candidates get 24. And an argument against it is that's not enough benefit to being first versus being second, a difference of only between 25 and 24 points. In baseball, MVP voting, they use a variation of the board account. The voters who are baseball sports writers rank 10 candidates. The variation of the board account there is the first place candidates, instead of being given 10 points, are given 14. After that, it's like normal. Second place candidates get 9, third place gets 8, and so forth, down to the last place candidate gets 1.
Is that based on any kind of research? Not that I can tell. It's just arbitrary?
Only on the fact that it seems like the baseball writers wanted to have extra benefit given to their first place candidate.
Okay.
But that change to the system is in itself controversial, because every few years something happens that like, for instance, last year in the American League Most Valuable Player voting, Vladimir Guerrero finished first, Gary Sheffield finished second, and Manny Ramirez finished third in the current system, 14 points for a first-place vote, 9 for a second, and so forth. As it turns out, if they used a regular board account, 10 points for a first-place vote, Sheffield and Ramirez would have had identical board point totals, which isn't so the winner would still have won decisively, but the second and third place candidates, if we used a regular board account, would have tied. That doesn't mean anything to us. There's no benefit to or difference to us if the second place and third place candidates switch places. But it might mean something to Manny Ramirez, who, I don't know, but may have something built into his contract that he gets a bonus if he finishes in the top two in the MVP balloting.
Yeah.
And actually, we only have to go back to 2001 to see an instance where the winner would have been different. Ichiro Suzuki won the American League MVP in 2001. Jason Giambi was second. If we used a regular board account, Giambi would have won the MVP. The big cash award that goes along with it, even if there were no contract bonus to him for finishing first, there would have at least been a cash prize and the award itself different if we used the regular system. And that's why in 2001 there was an outcry after the results were announced. Why are we doing it this way? Why do we have 14 points for a first-place vote? Why not do the regular board account? Of course, it was Jason Giambi supporters who were the ones arguing.
Yeah. The college I went to in Michigan, which was University of Michigan, they had a student assembly and a Michigan student government that in the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, where they used board account to elect all the student representatives there. And I never heard of any dissatisfaction. It was a standard board account. I never heard of any dissatisfaction with that method. I never heard any complaints about it. There was never any controversy to my knowledge.
Well, I'm betting there was only a handful of people that paid attention to how the votes were tabulated.
Yeah, okay.
And possibly a smaller number of candidates also. Rick mentioned the problem with having 25 candidates. There's a number of problems with that, and actually more than 25 candidates, just the first 25 that get points in the sports rankings. But you might have a situation where you really don't know how to form your preferences over those 25 candidates. I mean, the difference between, say, who is number 17 on your list and number 18 on your list, that can be very hard to determine even in your own mind. And
yes.
So whenever we have a large number of candidates and we're asked to rank them, those rankings can be somewhat arbitrary, and even subtle differences in the rankings can cause effects on the election outcomes. Also, Rick mentioned the difference between first place and second place, obviously when you have 25 candidates and your point totals are going from 25 to 1, with that range, a difference of 1 point is not very significant. On the other hand, if you have three or four candidates, you're looking at, say, the difference between 3 points and 2 points.
Yes.
That becomes more significant.
Yeah. No, that's actually an accurate point that you're stating there. There really wasn't for each seat. Gosh, there might have been three or four students who'd run for one slot. So it was easy to keep track of, you know, make your choices and rank them. But I think back, and I don't think I would have had I don't think I would have been sincerely ranking 25 for a ballot slot. That's a bit much.
Well, you can, you know, you go beyond that even, and we talked about this last time a little bit, but for instance, the California gubernatorial recall election, you know, you had 135 candidates on the ballot. Every system you use is going to have some sort of problem with that because of either we're going to be forced to rank those candidates to try to take into account something other than a first place choice, or we might elect somebody who gets a relatively small percentage of first place votes if those votes are pretty evenly distributed among the candidates, and could in fact be the last choice of many of the people in the electorate. So a lot of the problems with voting do come up because we have more candidates. I mean, the simplest case is if we only have two candidates, and that's a pretty easy case to deal with. Another famous theorem, Mayes' theorem, says if we have two candidates, essentially we should use majority rule, which makes sense.
Yeah.
The trouble comes in when we have more than two candidates, and that's where a lot of the paradoxical behavior is evidenced, and certainly that gets worse as the number of candidates increases.
Let's let's kind of look at the history of what's called apportionment, which is basically it's kind of the divvying out of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Can you give our listeners some kind of history about that?
Yeah, also very interesting. Surprisingly, a lot of American history in there too. And whenever I teach this subject in a course, I always litter it with historical nuggets. Like, for instance, the very first presidential veto in U.S. history was George Washington vetoing an apportionment method, and there's a lot of controversy surrounding that that first ever presidential veto, because it was a method proposed by Alexander Hamilton that Washington vetoed in favor of a method proposed by Thomas Jefferson. The reason the controversy exists is because Jefferson's method was very much in the benefit of his home state of Virginia, and which was also the home state of George Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So some conspiracy theorists, anyways, have speculated that George Washington vetoed Hamilton's method in favor of Jefferson specifically because it benefited his home state. Now, over the years, as those two methods have been studied, it's been determined that Hamilton's method, which appears on the surface to be the obvious method to use, has some pretty serious problems.
Yeah.
It's in doubt, however, that George Washington knew that, because if George Washington had known that, then the problems with it would have surfaced a lot sooner than they did.
Mm-hmm.
Hamilton's method was basically, so the problem with giving seats in the House of Representatives is we give seats, as the Constitution says, based on the populations of the states. Every state, based on its population, the proportion of their population of the entire country, that they should get an exact number of seats. The problem is that exact number of seats it has a decimal part, and we can't have fractional parts of seats. Every state has to get a whole number of seats.
Yeah.
Hamilton's method was pretty simple. It was just round those numbers up if the fractional parts are high, and round them down if the fractional parts are low, and do it in a way so it gives away exactly some specific number of seats. Jefferson's method was much different. It wanted to throw away the fractional parts. It was more mathematically difficult to implement, and yet it was the one that Washington was in favor of, and it was the one that ultimately went through because Congress did not have enough votes to override that first ever presidential veto.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one kind of interesting fact. The first presidential veto was something related to mathematics. And whether Washington ultimately understood the problems with Hamilton's method, he vetoed it. And maybe he understood those problems.
Yeah. Is Jefferson's method...
the methods that we use now, which are neither one of those two methods, we currently use a method that was proposed by Joseph Hill, the chief statistician of the Census Bureau back in the early 1900s. There are currently two methods that would be under consideration, that method and one that was proposed by Daniel Webster in the early 1800s. The reason that we use Hill's method is because of a political reason over Webster's method, even though most professional apportionment theorists would say that Webster's method is the one to use. It's the one that more accurately, consistently gives a number of seats that would be representative of the populations. And even though, although I should mention it, in fairness to Hill's method, when the two methods were studied by the National Academy of Sciences, they endorsed Hill's method. So there's some controversy there now that people just don't know about. People don't understand that there's some pretty simple mathematics that underlies something as important as how many seats states get in the House of Representatives.
And the two methods that Rick was mentioning there, Webster's and the Hill-Huntington method, are both fairly similar. They differ only very slightly in the rule that they use to round numbers. So most of the time, those two are going to give the same apportionment. And there is a fair amount of debate, or there was anyway, about which one was better. So Rick's right in saying that that was a political move that selected Hill's method, but it's still a pretty reasonable method to use, all things considered.
Right, and the difference between the two methods would generally just be one or two seats total. And in 1794, the difference between Jefferson and Hamilton's methods was a single seat. Jefferson's gave one extra seat to Virginia that Hamilton's method gave to Delaware, I think. So when I say, you know, it was very much in the benefit of Virginia, I'm talking about a single seat, which, you know, doesn't seem like that much. But to Delaware in 1794 and to Virginia in 1794, it was definitely noticeable.
And at that time, that was the only the House of Representatives was the only legislative body, federal legislative body, that was elected by the people, because the Senate was elected by the state legislatures. Am I correct?
Oh, didn't know that. Wow.
No, the Senate.
I've only studied apportionment in the House of Representatives, because that's where the mathematics comes in.
Yeah. The Senate was it's two senators per state, but it's they were not directly elected at that time. So that was the only legislative body, federal legislative body, that citizens could vote for at the time. So I guess it was a big thing.
So there's been a lot of controversy about apportionment. It's not just that veto of Washington's veto of Jefferson's method, but there's been other controversy that I mentioned last time, a month ago when we were on the show. Specific controversies that happened through the 1800s, one of which cost Samuel Tilden an election and gave it to Rutherford B. Hayes. That probably the grossest problem with apportionment that's ever happened is the fact that an apportionment problem, a misuse of apportionment, a misapportioned house cost Sam Tilden the election and gave it to Rutherford B. Hayes. And that's not up for debate. That is an obvious fact.
Yeah. That was a situation where Tilden actually received not only a plurality of the popular vote, but a majority. He got 51% of the popular vote in 1876 and still lost the election. So
lost the election because the Electoral College, which is based on number of representatives, was miscounted, not accidentally, miscounted on purpose in an unconstitutional apportionment.
And that's amazing.
Yeah, so a lot of people don't know about little problems like that. They don't happen that often, but they have. And like I said at the start, these aren't things that theoretically could happen. These are things that did happen.
Yeah.
And could happen again.
Yeah.
But it, now, another thing that's worth mentioning here, and I'm the one who gets to tell about all the negative results here. Rick just gets to talk about sports because that's what he knows about. With apportionment, we have an impossibility theorem that's really similar to the impossibility theorems that we have in other areas of voting theory that essentially, loosely stated, says there's no perfect apportionment method. More precisely, every apportionment method suffers one of two specific types of problems. Again, we see this theme that we have to compromise, and we have to kind of pick and choose which criteria are going to be important to us, not only in voting systems, but in apportionment methods and how we use them. I also want to just mention, Rick said earlier that, you know, he had studied apportionment within the context of the House of Representatives, and that is where it's by far the most popular place to study the topic. But apportionment comes up in lots of other situations, and I'll just mention one. From this summer, some of the research I was doing, we were simulating elections, and I had to use apportionment methods to decide how to allocate simulated voters to preferences. Hmm. So if you want to simulate an election, you want to have a certain number of voters with a certain type of preferences, and that might turn out to be a non-integer number of voters. You might have a decimal part there. So the question is, if we're trying to allocate voters into these different classes for the purposes of running a simulation, how should we decide what to do with those places where we need to round? So actually,
how did you do it?
You know, just because of implementation and writing the algorithm, I used Hamilton's method because it's
definitely the easiest
to implement.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a situation where having an extra voter here or there was going to make a big difference in the simulation.
Right.
So, and again, that's a good example of sometimes we have to take these theoretical results. And I said, well, sure, I know that Hamilton's method is probably not the best apportionment method to use. If I was apportioning the House of Representatives, I wouldn't want to use Hamilton's method. But for the purposes I was interested in, convenience of implementation and the fact that it wasn't really important to get a completely accurate apportionment trumped the fact that Hamilton's method was not one of the better methods.
Yeah. And that's actually a very good point, convenience of implementation. Despite the negative things that we have said about the board account today, it is very highly regarded and by many voting theorists. I think I mentioned that earlier, as a matter of fact. Yeah. However, in many instances, it's not a convenient thing to implement for the ranking issue that was brought up earlier,
yeah.
Like the California gubernatorial recall election from a few years ago. Who would want to rank 135 candidates? And if you wanted to use the board account, you would have to. And even if you didn't want to have to rank all of them, if you just wanted to rank a few of them, like there's a 112 or so football teams that could be ranked, and they only rank 25 of them, that's a pretty small percentage, ranking only 25 out of 112, or however many it is. To me, it would be a difficult thing to do, have to even rank 25.
And even then, if you're only ranking those top teams, you've changed the system again, and you have to examine, you know, have I introduced anything into the system that's going to produce unexpected consequences?
Yeah.
So, from a theoretical standpoint, you can argue, and people like Don Sari have argued, that the board account's just about as good as it gets in terms of avoiding some of the problems that have historically been identified with voting systems. But like Rick mentioned, from an implementation standpoint, sometimes just having those ranked ballots is impractical. And so that's why a lot of people who study these things prefer systems like approval voting, where you're not ranking candidates, but instead just specifying which candidates you approve of and consequently which you disapprove of. That's a much simpler ballot. It's a restriction of the types of preferences you can express, but it's also it's also a way to provide more information than plurality does without having to provide a complete ranking.
Yes. Gentlemen, we're going to take a quick break for some public service announcements. We'll be back with Rick Klima and John Hodge after these messages.
You are listening to Hawk Radio, the number one college radio station streaming on the net.
Hawk Radio is proud to be a member of the Broadcast Education Association. Hawk Radio has been a member of the BEA since 1998. The Broadcast Education Association is the professional development organization for professors, college, university, and professionals involved in educating and training students to work in television, radio, and electronic media industry. Hawk Radio, training future broadcasters today.
Dennis plays the kind of music that I like. He just shouldn't sing along with it.
Oh, yeah. I do that so other people don't get it. You know?
It's the only karaoke station in town. You know? Nobody else does it.
And when I tell you to do that, I always tell you to keep two hands on the wheel, you know, because, like, if you start clapping and singing along with the songs I play, man, you're going to wind up in a ditch somewhere.
He can play whatever he wants. He can sing. He doesn't have a problem not to.
All right.
Listen to Hail Hawk Rock and Roll. Sing and dance at your own risk. You're enjoying Hawk Radio. Hawk Radio can be heard on the net at www.hawkradio.com 24 hours a day. Listen at home or in your office. Our email address is dj@hawkradio.com or give us a call, area code 813-253-7592.
Hawk Radio.
The revolution will be broadcast.
With John Hodge and Rick Klima, we're talking about voting in elections. John and Rick are the authors of The Mathematics of Voting Elections, a hands-on approach. It is published by the American Mathematical Society. It is 226 pages, soft cover, published this year. I'll give you the ISBN. It's 0-8218-3798. -2. It lists for $35. You can order it at the AMS website or from your favorite bookstore. The AMS website is www.ams.org/bookstore. The order code is MAWRLD/22. Well, and it's being translated into Russian right now. Because
listening to this on the internet in Russia. From your bookstore there, too.
In a year from now, probably.
Yes.
I guess it'll take a while to translate.
Jonathan Hodge has done some research in referendum elections, some solutions to some of the very peculiar results that can happen when you combine when you vote on more than one issue. When you go into 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or in the case of California, I think back in 2003, was it 26 or something, issues, you can end up in a situation where literally nobody likes the results. Then that is because some voters or all voters perceive some issues, some referendum tied in with others. In other words, there's some connectivity between them. One depends on the other.
Right.
And in that election, I read somewhere where of all the votes cast on each of those questions, and you look at the final outcome, the yes, no, no, yes, yes, no sequence of the final outcome, which ones passed and which ones did not, not one voter in the state of California, we're talking millions of people here, not one voter voted for that outcome.
Wow.
Is that bizarre?
Yeah. Well, it is on the surface. But when you think about an election with 28 different propositions and you look at the number of combinations of yes-no votes you could have on that,
that's
2 to the 28th, which is just an enormously
large
number.
Number.
And even with millions...
268 million.
Okay, so 268 million. So if we had 268 million voters, we would expect each of those outcomes on average to get a vote if the votes were uniformly distributed. But... chances are they wouldn't be, and so you would expect in that situation that most outcomes, possibly including the winning outcome, would receive no votes at all. And as you said, Tom, the problem here is that when I go to vote on, we could say 28 issues, but let's even say the simplest case, two issues, Proposal A and Proposal B, if they're related in some way, perhaps bond proposals that draw funds from the same tax base, or proposals for related plans to renovate parks or whatnot. I might want both of the proposals to pass in theory, but maybe I feel like if both of them passed, that would put too much of a strain on the taxpayers. So my preferences might be something like I want Proposal A to pass, but only if Proposal B fails, and I want Proposal B to pass, but only if Proposal A fails.
Yeah.
And it's not too hard to imagine that lots of voters with those sorts of preferences, if they voted sincerely, could effectively end up in a situation which is the worst situation for them, where both issues cast or both issues pass because of the combination of votes, and that could conceivably be the last choice of those voters.
Yeah,
right, and that's important. It's not just the fact that the result, the outcome of the election, could be something that nobody likes as their first place choice. It could be the result could be the last place choice of most of the voters.
Yes.
And if you go to an election with three questions, it's in fact theoretically possible for the outcome of such an election to be the last choice of every single voter. Now, if you start thinking about things like that, a natural question is, well, okay, that's theoretically possible, but would this ever happen in real life? And it's hard to answer that question because we don't often have information about people's rankings of outcomes. We have their first choices.
Yes.
So this past summer, a student and I were working on a research project where we tried to simulate some elections, and this is what I mentioned earlier when we were discussing apportionment. One of the surprising results we found, outcomes that you would expect would have to be the result of lots of contrived examples and really trying to tweak things so they're just right to get such bad behavior, they actually come up randomly. We ran one simulation with 200 elections where there's actually an election where the winning outcome was the last choice of every single voter.
Wow.
And this was, we only had to run 200 elections to see this. And what we were finding is that outcomes that are near that level, so the last choice of every voter, the last choice of many voters, or the last or second to last choice of virtually every voter.
How many issues
like that were showing up?
How many issues
up in situations that would be fairly reasonable in actual elections?
Yeah. How many issues were you voting on in each election?
In that particular case, it was just a three-question election, but we saw similar behavior in four-question elections too.
So, am I right in guessing that the more questions that you would have per election, the worse that situation would become?
Well, that's the reasonable assumption, and I think that's correct. From a simulation standpoint, it's hard to simulate things above four questions for a number of reasons. One of which is that we don't have we want to control for certain characteristics of preferences. Specifically, we wanted to be able to control for preferences that did or did not have the types of interdependencies you mentioned.
Yeah.
And those types of preferences have only been characterized completely up to the N equals 4 case, so up to the case where we have four questions.
Uh-huh.
So that's why most of our simulations had to be centered around there. But what we do know is that as the number of questions increases, it becomes far more likely that a randomly selected preference would exhibit these interdependencies that cause problems. And so one can only assume that the situation would get worse.
So these bizarre referenda that we've been having, and one we had in Florida here not just a few years ago, was I think Floridians will be familiar with the Pregnant Pig Amendment, where we had a case where we had two pig farms in the state of Florida. People, I don't really think, cared a whole lot about it, but somehow it was tied in with some other issues on the ballot, and it somehow passed. And then there was another one that was called colloquially the bullet train, which was really a magnetic levitation train, which is a really undeveloped, untested, untried technology that somebody tried to get built here in Florida at the cost of billions of dollars. And that passed. Now, we had another referendum election where it got rescinded. But I think if we look back at that election, we'll see we can see how strange and how paradoxical and how bizarre the outcomes can be.
You mentioned that I think what you called the Pregnant Pig Amendment. A lot of people just didn't care, and sometimes that indifference, where I'm teetering between, well, I really don't care if I should vote yes or no, and I'm just going to vote one or the other, having a not very well thought out voting strategy like that in a close election can make a big difference in the outcome. It can ultimately lead to an outcome that's far from desirable. Quite inadvertently, by voting on an issue that you didn't really care about, you cause something negative to happen. So there are lots of things like this, and you know, referendum elections have gotten a lot of positive press, and probably rightfully so, for giving voters a direct say in issues that are important to them. And I think there's a lot of merit to that.
Yes.
The criticisms of referendum elections have, for the most part, been focused around, well, are voters informed enough to make these decisions? Will they understand the issues? The more recent criticism from a mathematical standpoint is maybe the very mechanism of a referendum election and the way voters' preferences are structured is not conducive to giving results that actually do represent what the people want. And so that's where a lot of research still needs to be done in terms of how we can avoid some of these problems and what we can do to ensure better outcomes in these types of elections.
Has your research revealed any? So I guess your research has begun to address that problem. That's the way the system is set up now is perhaps not ideal.
Yeah, well, we've seen some interesting results that I think we're getting closer to being able to at least make some preliminary conclusions about what other options might be available. The way referendum elections are typically held, you vote on each issue individually. I mean, you vote on them all at the same time, but your yes vote on Proposal A and a no vote on Proposal B is counted separately for Proposal A first and then for Proposal B. And so whichever proposal on each of the proposals, whichever outcome, yes or no, gets the majority of votes, that's the outcome. You could also view your vote as, say, in a three-question election, yes, no, yes, as being, instead of a vote in three individual elections, a vote for the outcome, yes, no, yes. In that case, you're not separating in your mind or on your ballot each of the individual issues. You're saying what I want for the overall outcome of the election is for the first issue to pass, the second issue to fail, right, and the third issue to pass. And it seems that when a large percentage of the electorate has interdependent preferences, this type of set-wise voting, even set-wise voting where we're just counting first-place choices for the overall election or the overall outcome of the election, holds some promise. It's when you have about 40% or more of the electorate with interdependent preferences, it seems that this type of voting is more likely than not to produce a better outcome than the outcome of simultaneous voting.
So have you run any simulations like that?
Yes, we've run lots of simulations that We don't understand why the break seems to be at about 40% of the electorate having interdependent preferences, but that seems to be what's coming up in the simulations that we have run. An interesting question that we haven't pursued is, what if you combine a set-wise voting technique with some other more desirable aggregation methods like the board account or approval voting or things of this sort that might give an even better outcome yet? Now, the other reasonable option, if preferences are interdependent, it's logical to say, well, what if we sequence the election? So vote on the first question, vote on the second question, then vote on the third question, and announce the intermediate results along the way so that we can provide voters with the information that they need. Interestingly enough, sometimes providing that information produces worse results than if it hadn't been provided. But what we're seeing in the research we did this summer is that that's not often the case, that usually sequencing an election, it seems like no matter which way we sequence it, more often than not, and it's a significant percentage, a significant amount more likely than not, the sequential voting produces a better outcome than simultaneous voting.
Better according to what criteria?
And that's a good question. So the criteria we use to evaluate the desirability of an election outcome is closely related to the border count. There's points assigned to the outcome for each voter based on how they ranked that outcome. When I say the best election outcome, that would be one that actually would maximize the border count score. And obviously that's not the only way of doing it, but that's the way that we looked at it this summer.
And in your book you have you've published some, I think, research that you did in part of your doctoral dissertation on a method of voting which kind of combines the simultaneous with the sequential.
Oh, yes. There has been some research, and that's related to what we were just talking about a few minutes ago. Before our research this summer, there was a theoretical result that said essentially that if you sequence an election by first voting on all but one of the questions simultaneously, and then sequencing off one question at the end, and presumably the question you would sequence off would be the one that you suspect is more likely to be dependent on the others. If you sequence off just one question at the end, that won't make matters worse. In other words, the outcome of that type of election will not be viewed as worse by a majority of voters than the outcome of the corresponding simultaneous election.
Uh-huh.
What we're seeing, in fact, is that that the outcome of that election, in fact, in the simulations we run, is often better.
So the only problem with that is everyone has to go back and vote one more time.
Right, which is better, though, than having to go back and vote six more times,
right.
Which is one of the major problems with election sequencing in the first place, is it would be so costly and time-consuming that to sequence, say, 28 questions, 28 propositions, I mean, we'd be running the election for years, probably.
Right.
This might be a compromise solution, and it's certainly worth further research. It's worth more exploration to see if this is something that, if implemented, would be a reasonable way to solve some of these problems.
So what we could do is, for example, if I interpret this correctly, is the first set of questions we vote on with like set-wise voting. That is, we're voting on it simultaneously, and we'd use like a board account. Let's say, provided it isn't too great a number of questions, maybe two or three, use like a board account to rate our preferences, and then that is tallied, and the winner, the winning preference profile is announced, and then we come back and we vote on the last question. Is that how it would be done?
Yes, and probably a first step would just be to not even worry about the board account or set-wise voting in that first election.
Okay.
See, change in these areas will happen very slowly. And I think the general public is not always interested in the mathematics behind these things. And so to propose a simple modification, let's vote on all but one of the questions and then vote on the last one separately, with some basic intuitive justification for that, there's an area where we might be able to enact some change that has some research behind it.
Yeah. And you say the result of that is can't be worse or is likely to not be
worse. Well, that's right. It cannot be viewed as worse by a majority of the voters.
How likely is it that it would be viewed as better?
Well, I don't remember that figure right off the top of my head. What I can say is the likelihood that it would be viewed as the same or better is in the 90% range for what we've seen. So that's using a different measure. So that's why there's an apparent contradiction there. It can't be worse according to being majority preferred to the outcome or by the outcome of simultaneous voting, but there is a chance that if you looked at this in a board account sense, there could be other outcomes that were slightly better. But overall, sequencing off that one question is not likely to do very much harm at all.
Hopefully, the likelihood of it doing better would outweigh the extra work of going back to vote one more time.
And I think so. I think that if I remember correctly, the likelihood of that being better is somewhere up in the 40 or 50% based on the simulations that we've seen. So it's a significant percentage.
Yeah, certainly, it would be worthwhile then.
Yep.
Gentlemen, we are running out of time here. I wish we had another hour. I have been interviewing today Jonathan Hodge and Richard Klima, who are the authors of The Mathematics of Voting in Elections, A Hands-On Approach. Their book is published by the American Mathematical Society. It was published this year. I'll give you the ISBN number, ISBN 0-8218-3798-2. It lists for $35. Pick it up in your favorite bookstore. You can order it online at www.ams.org. We are quickly running out of time. I'm going to have to scooch. I want to thank Rick and John. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Have a fun.
And next week we'll be back with another interesting guest. I'm your host, Tom Smith. Bye-bye.